Support for Sound Ideas comes from Bloomington Normal Audiology, the best hearing device center in the Pantograph Reader's Choice Awards for the sixth year in a row. Bloomington Normal Audiology thanks the listeners and their continued vote of confidence as the leaders in hearing and technology. With a practice featuring five doctors, including two who wear hearing devices themselves, BNA takes a genuine interest in each patient and helps you keep hearing the most important sounds of your life. More information at bnaudiology.com. Bloomington Normal Audiology, here for you.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Newly retired Judge Scott Drzeski helped establish McLean County's first drug court.
We were actually late to the party because we didn't create ours for many years after that. And we actually missed an opportunity, maybe 10 years before that, for it to occur.
Judge Drzeski reflects on his career. Plus, it was the best of years for Illinois farmers and the worst of years for them as well. It all depends on what you grew. A wave of evictions is coming as pandemic protections prepare to sunset. And hear about an ultraviolet robot that can tamp down bacteria in your home, developed in central Illinois. All that and a news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on WGLT. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Let's run down some of the day's top stories. The family of a Bloomington nursing home resident who died of COVID-19 is suing the facility's owner. Anita Martin of Bloomington claims Bloomington Rehabilitation and Healthcare Center disregarded the health and safety of its residents amid the pandemic. Martin's mother, Marlene Cowens-Hill, was one of 11 people at the home who have died of COVID-19. Attorney Megan Shore filed the lawsuit. She says the nursing home didn't follow COVID protocols and has a history of neglecting residents.
So there's clearly a systemic problem within this facility that was not being addressed.
Peoria-based Peterson Healthcare owns the nursing home. The company says it doesn't comment on ongoing legal matters. The McLean County Health Department reports 12 more COVID-19 related deaths and 299 new confirmed cases over the holiday weekend. This brings the county's death toll since the start of the pandemic to 113. All of the deaths reported Monday were older adults between the ages of 60 and 100. Eight were residents of long-term care facilities. McLean County's testing positivity rate, hospitalizations, and total bed capacity improved. There are currently 18 people from McLean County hospitalized with COVID-19. More than one in four hospital beds are currently open, though intensive care bed capacity tightened. Free COVID testing begins tomorrow at the Ferrero Candy plant in Bloomington. The city says the drive-up site on the southwest side of town can do 300 tests per day for the general public, in addition to candy company workers. Carl Health continues progress in absorbing pieces of former Broman Healthcare Ventures. Carl says it has combined the Community Cancer Center Foundation with the existing Carl Center for Philanthropy. The cancer center itself was renamed the Carl Cancer Institute of Normal when Carl bought out Advocate and OSF Healthcare gave up its joint operation of the cancer center. Carl Broman Vice President of Development Shelley Burlingmare says gifts earmarked for the Cancer Institute will stay local to Bloomington. Normal. OSF has also begun its own cancer treatment center in Bloomington. The ice storm continues to affect central Illinois with persistent power outages and other inconveniences. As of early afternoon, nearly 1,400 Bloomington Normal residents still had no power from Ameren, Illinois, and more than 1,500 total in McLean County. The town of Normal has also closed Constitution Trail because of low-hanging ice-laden branches and heavy tree damage. The Parks and Recreation Department says there's a risk of falling branches until there's a significant thaw. Town staff ask residents for patience and say it will take some time to collect tree limbs and debris from curbs because of the extensive damage. Illinois Republicans say their top priority in the lame duck legislative session is cuts to the state budget. The General Assembly convenes Friday for that session. House Deputy Minority Leader Dan Brady says the Republican caucus still faces uncertainty over what sorts of bills will be discussed.
What each committee may be scheduled for and what the subject matter and action may or may not be obviously remains undetermined at this point in time. And that's in part of the frustration that we are all field.
Democrats in the House and Senate have introduced legislation that would allow the General Assembly to do remote work. The lame duck session in Springfield will be the first time state lawmakers have convened since last May. The traditional fall veto session was canceled. The next General Assembly is set to be inaugurated January 13th. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM WGLT and WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Support for WGLT comes from Bloomington Normal Audiology. With a practice featuring five doctors, including two who wear hearing devices themselves, BNA takes a genuine interest in each patient. They believe those personal partnerships are how people embrace hearing technology and keep hearing the most important sounds of their lives. More information at bnaudiology.com.
You're listening to Bloomington Normal's Public Media. Last year was a tough one financially for many people, but for farmers, the bottom line was pretty good. A new USDA report shows net farm income jumped sharply in 2020, 43%, to over $119 billion. The big reason was government payments. University of Illinois farm management professor Gary Schnittke tells Ryan Denham the year that was depends on what kind of farmer you are.
If you're a crop farmer, grain and or corn and soybean farmer in Illinois, it probably did not turn out to be too bad. And what happened was their prices plummeted in March and April, went way down. And then, and so we got some federal aid coming to farms, which helped out a lot. And then prices have rebounded in recent months from a variety of factors. So the grain farms are going to do okay and probably have a pretty good income year in Illinois and across the nation. The farms that are going to have less income this year are livestock farms in general. Dairy would be one that had a rough spell through there. For example, hogs, beef. And hog farms in particular had, you know, and both hog and beef farms had huge problems with getting their animals processed during that April, May, June period. We had COVID backing up processing plants. And once those backups happened, we had animals that needed to be process that were delayed, and that all was what turned out to be not fun. So livestock farms are not going to have a good year, and how bad it is will depend on risk management on the farm and several other things.
So if you look at why income rose for farmers, how much of a role were direct government payments in that picture? Were they the main driver or just a driver?
So federal aid this year is a very large driver of incomes. We had several rounds of CFAP, Coronavirus Food Assistance Program, that happened in 2020. Those totaled, depending on the farm, $50, $60 per acre, and that would vary a lot across farms, but that was very key in having a very good income year for 2020. So it was absolutely critical. The last 3 years, actually, MFP and CFAP and other federal aid programs have been large components of income on grain farms in 2018, 2019, and 2020.
Our listeners here may be familiar with MFP. What you're talking about there is the Market Facilitation Program. It's a big, big federal program that was offered to help farmers impacted by trade disputes. McLean County, because of our size and what we grow, we were like a major recipient of that, you know, probably a top five county nationwide for how much money MFP brought into our county. But let's stay on the income thing. Was it such a good year from an income perspective that it may have an interesting effect on, you know, what sort of spending decisions farmers make in the new year, you know, plopping down money for a new piece of equipment or, you know, the other things that they put into the property?
It's an okay to above average year. It's not, so grain farms incomes were very good in sort of the period from before 2012. And a lot of that had to be from 2008 to 2012. We had very good grain farm incomes, and we will not be at those levels again in 2020. 2013 through onward have been sort of average, where we have sort of $70,000-ish per farm of net farm income on these grain farms. This one, this year is going to be above that. It's not going to be a sort of a situation where it's going to be above average. It's going to allow farmers to replenish their current, their liquidity positions. They will probably continue to make the usual needed machinery investments and that sort of thing. So it's not going to hamper that, but it's not one of those years where we're back to like 2012, 2011, and 2010.
There's a reporter at NPR who I follow on Twitter, a guy named Dan Charles. And, you know, after these numbers on farm income came out, he said something along the lines of, all in all, 2020 has worked out just fine for your average farm enterprise. Is that a fair read of this data, or is there more nuance to it than that?
Well, there is more nuance to it than that. Again, grain farms came out okay. The livestock farms had a very tough year. So, you know, when we're looking at those, particularly those average USDA numbers, you know, the average is okay, but there are sectors where it's above average and it's other sectors where it's below average. So, you know, really, if you look at it from a U.S. standpoint, there really isn't an average. I mean, you look at you're in McLean County. A corn and soybean operation in McLean County is different from a wheat operation in Montana to a cotton farm in Texas. So, you know, you're averaging over a lot of different things.
That's University of Illinois Farm Management Professor Gary Schnitke speaking with Ryan Denham. Newly retired McLean County Circuit Judge Scott Drzeski says when he was young, he wanted to become a veterinarian. That lasted until he saw surgery. Instead, he spent his career in another, sometimes messy field, the law. Correspondent Edith Brady Lunny talks with Drzeski about his career and about his role in the founding of McLean County's first drug court to divert offenders from prison through intensive recovery services.
Really, even though we knew, based upon statistics across the country, because the first drug court in Miami-Dade was created, I think, in the mid-80s. And so we were actually late to the party because we didn't create ours for many years after that. And we actually missed an opportunity, maybe 10 years before that, for it to occur. But when we kept seeing the statistics and the fact that the recidivism rate was significantly better than individuals who were placed on ordinary terms of probation, you just can't turn a blind eye to that and say, well, maybe it's one court or otherwise. By then, there were dozens of courts across the country that were showing success. You knew that the time and the effort that you were putting in truly caring for these people who have an addiction. They have a medical condition that you can and will be able to make their lives better, hopefully long term.
There are limited choices that addicts face if they don't get the help they need.
I have not coined this phrase. I just stole it. You know, the life of an addict. There are only limited options. You can either be incarcerated. You can be institutionalized, or you can be in the ground. And we saw that happen time and time again. And those that broke free from the chains of addiction, they have new opportunities and opportunities that they never thought would happen. Having their dignity returned to them, not being looked as a pariah, for example, by family members, and reincorporating and reintegrating families. So it can be just a wonderful experience that brings, you know, tears to your eyes just to hear the success stories from individuals who have had their lives changed.
Statistically, the recidivism rate is lower for drug court graduates than other offenders.
It is. And the problem is you're always tinkering with with what works. Just like there's new drugs that come out whether it's every month, every year, or otherwise, that present new challenges. And so, you know, when you're dealing with the common drugs, whether it was at that time cocaine or heroin, for example, then all of a sudden you get these synthetics. And so bath salts, for example, that just really threw people off, and you couldn't test for them, and you knew what the problems were. Anyway, you have to address that, and then they constantly learn through evidence-based practices what works and what doesn't. And that's why it's so important that there be continuing education, because what may have worked 2 or 3 years ago no longer works. In fact, sometimes we find that what we thought was a wonderful idea turns out to be anything but that. Case in point being when you would match, for example, somebody who was a low-risk individual with someone who was a high-risk individual. You know, you would think that would help them. Well, what you find is that low-risk person then gravitates to become a high-risk person because they learn from that high-risk individual on how to do things and not good things.
Also, during your more than 2 decades on the bench, you've handled some very high-profile cases. Those had a lot of public interest, and thinking about the Beeson murder case and more recently the Kirk Zimmerman murder case. What are some of the challenges of presiding, rather, over cases like that, and some of them lasting more than a month?
Maintaining your sense of balance, maintaining your sense of who you are, because if you really think about the horror of some of those situations, and so, for example, when you talk about Beeson, and any murder is obviously a horrific event, but a multiple mass murder of a family, it's hard to wrap your head around it, and so you have to be fair-minded and open-minded and recognize that there are competing interests there. There's the competing interests, obviously, of the victims, of needing and wanting justice, and their families, wanting justice, and society also wanting to make sure that the individual or individuals who are responsible for perpetrating and committing the crimes, that they are appropriately punished with the constitutional rights that any defendant has, regardless of the type of crime.
And from my time in covering you on the bench, one thing that really stands out to me is that when you walk out in the morning, most days, you appear very happy to be there. Is there something, do you think, maybe about your personality in particular that would help lower the level of anxiety and tension maybe that people would feel during those high-profile cases?
But it's hard. I mean, you want to be pleasant. You want to be nice. You want to make people feel as though they're welcome, because they really are. But then we counteract that, obviously, with the purpose that we're there. And there's nothing uplifting about going through a lengthy murder case. I mean, you know that there's a lot of sorrow, there's and sadness and emotional upheaval that people are enduring. And so other than making them welcome and, if not specifically, thanking them for being there with every opportunity that you can, to let them know that they are important, that they are important to the process, and not to have it be a negative experience, to have it be as positive as possible under those set of circumstances.
Judge Scott Drzeski retired at the end of the year. He spoke with correspondent Edith Brady Lunny. The bench is overwhelmingly white and male in most jurisdictions. Drzeski says judicial diversity is something to work toward, but it should not be forced. He notes it took more than 3 decades for the number of women to even out the male population coming out of law school. He says that is affecting the number of women judges, and the diversity of judges will improve over time as well. You're listening to 89.1 FM and WGLT.org. An ultraviolet robot under development in Peoria could be an affordable and safe sanitation option for hospitals, offices, and other indoor spaces. Tim Shelley speaks with Suraz Mia, an assistant professor of electrical and computer engineering at Bradley University, about his concept.
The main function of this robot is to disinfect areas such as hospitals, offices, for example, classrooms, and also this robot can be deployed where human beings are in danger. Okay, so the main function is to disinfect areas. That's the main function of this robot that we are expecting.
How does it work exactly?
Okay, so it is completely autonomous. It's autonomous robot. There will be an UV light will be mounted on top of the robot. And also this robot is mounted with some sort of spraying machine so that it can spray vertically and horizontally as well. And it disinfects areas by spreading UV light.
Got it. And can you describe it a little bit? I mean, how big is it? I'm kind of picturing like a Roomba here almost.
Yeah, it's basically, you can think of it just like a Roomba robot that you can see, but its height is about a foot height. And the most important thing is that it is modular. For example, you can just take off UV light and you can just put it back. It doesn't have to be completely intact. It is modular. That's what I'm trying to say.
How did you come up with this idea?
Okay, so this idea, actually, I was talking to my friend at St. John's University, and we were in a meeting with some doctors as well. So we were talking about this sort of robots. And then since I work in the field of robotics, I took the initiative to actually design this robot. So the design is still under investigation.
So about how far in the process are you? I mean, do you have a timeline for when we might actually see this come out?
Yeah, so I have set up a timeline about a year. So I'm thinking of having this robot fully functional in about a year from now.
Got it. And I understand you're looking to also incorporate students into this process. If you could talk a little bit about that.
Actually, there are two students currently working on this project. So these students will keep working on this project to make it fully functional. And also, these robots require a bit of time for us to make the chassis, for example. And also, there are some other hardware that need to be incorporated. And it will take a bit of time, actually. But the initial timeline is about a year that we are planning to have this robot fully functional.
How much was this robot expected to cost?
We are thinking of having this robot cost less than $1,000. There are many robots available in the market that cost like $4,000 to $10,000, depending on the features. There are sophisticated, there are fancy robots available in the market, but the main purpose of this robot is to make it affordable to everybody, and cost is we are planning to have it less than $1,000.
Got it. And what are some of the advantages to this robot in terms of having a robot go in and clean an office or clean a hotel room or whatever the environment might be, as opposed to having people do it?
Yeah. So the main advantage of this robot is modular. Modular in the sense that you can actually just it just works like a plug and it is supposed to work just like a plug and play architecture. Okay, for example, UV light, you can just take it off, and then robot, you can then put it back, or different type of UV light you can put it. So we are thinking of making it completely modular. And the other advantage is that since I'm talking about modular a lot, so this robot would be able to adapt itself to some environment where it needs to spread vertically and also horizontally.
That's Suroz Mia, an assistant professor of electrical and computer engineering at Bradley University. He spoke with Tim Shelley. The Illinois eviction moratorium has been extended for another month. Eventually, it will end. Tim Shelley speaks with Prairie State Legal Services attorney Katie Pinter about the onslaught of cases they're expecting when that happens.
Since March, Illinois landlords haven't been able to evict most of their tenants for rent non-payment. Governor J.B. Pritzker has renewed his eviction moratoriums each month of the pandemic, but there are some recent changes. Pinter says covered persons protected by the moratorium are still expected to pay the rent as best they can, even if that means you'll have to scale back your holiday celebrations.
Try to make best efforts to pay. I know that it's going to be difficult, especially now and the next month, because when perhaps funds are dwindling.
Pinter says it will be difficult to protect tenants who have fallen behind on their rent once the moratorium is lifted.
People, even if they are paid up until the end of December, they might require further financial assistance come the new year. It's really hard to protect tenants when it's not a legal issue, it's a money issue.
The most recent moratorium order requires a landlord to give a tenant a form of declaration to become a covered person at least 5 days prior to issuing an eviction notice. Pinter says those declaration forms are also available through the Illinois Housing Development Authority or Prairie State Legal Services.
Contact an attorney if you do have questions and are seeking advice. Don't run away from the issue. Confront it, because the moratoriums will eventually end. So we want to put people in the best possible position when they do.
The moratorium is currently slated to end January 9th. I'm Tim Shelley.
Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT, made possible in part by Bloomington Normal Audiology. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories at WGLT.org. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Comment on our Facebook page, we're WGLT-FM, or follow us on Twitter, we're all at WGLT News. This is WGLT, Bloomington Normal's public media.